This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. I've watched baseball for a long time, and the more I see, the more I appreciate catchers. They aren't like the outfielders, gracefully loping under fly balls, or infielders diving for grounders. They're baseball's anonymous brutes, hidden behind masks and crouched behind the plate, eating dust from pitches in the dirt and getting clipped by foul balls. But the position is incredibly demanding, both physically and mentally. Besides doing 150 deep knee bends a day and absorbing collisions at the plate, catchers have to study hitters and call for just the right pitches and manage the psyches of their pitchers, young and old. I wanted to talk to a veteran catcher about the life he leads, and people who know steered me to Brad Ausmus. He retired last year after 18 seasons in the big leagues, 10 of them with the Houston Astros. He's a three-time Gold Glove winner and was named to the 1999 National League All-Star team. He caught more than 1,900 games in all, good for seventh place on the all-time list. He's now a special assistant to the general manager for the San Diego Padres. I spoke to Brad Ausmus last week. Well, Brad Ausmus, welcome to Fresh Air. As a catcher, your role is unique. You and the pitcher are busy on every play, while seven other guys, although they will do tremendous things from time to time, are standing around. Tell us, describe, if you will, some of the physical demands of catching in the big leagues.
Physically, it's mainly getting in and out of a squat. You do it not only during the course of the game, which is actually the easier part. You do it in the bullpen. You do it in spring training. You do it during the warm-ups. You do it prior to the game. At times, I've tried to total up the number of squats I've gotten into over the course of a season, and you know, you'd have to go 150 squats a day for 7 months, and you'd come up with the number. So your legs take a toll, especially when you get down to the last 2 months of the season. In August and September, you start to feel your legs getting tired. I remember walking up the stairs one season when I had a newborn, my second daughter, and I would walk halfway up the stairs to the landing, and I'd kind of have to rest because my legs were tired. So there is a physical demand mostly on your legs.
Do you catch one-handed with your bare hand behind your back for protection, or do you keep both hands out there?
Well, it changes based on the situation. If there's nobody on base, I keep my right hand or my throwing hand kind of to my side by my hip and down a little bit to protect it from a foul ball. Back 50 years ago, before there was changes in the catcher's mitt, it used to be just basically a pillow with a hole in the middle, or a dent in the middle that catchers would have to catch the ball and immediately put their throwing hand over it so it wouldn't pop out. And there's been a lot of changes in the catcher's mitt. It's hinged and it has a webbing. You don't really need two hands to catch the ball. So when there's nobody on base, the throwing hand, in order to protect it, is either behind me or down by my right hip. Now, if there's a runner on base that could possibly steal, or I need to be concerned with the ball in the dirt not getting by me, then I bring my hand that I actually lay it relaxed on the groin area or the inner thigh of my right leg, and it just kind of hangs there flat against my inner thigh. And it's in a good position there to either block the ball in the dirt or to be ready to throw a base stealer out.
And you hope you don't get a foul tip into that exposed arm or hand.
You're right, and it's a precarious position. What I've found is, first, in 18 years in the major leagues, I may have gotten hit in that spot 10 times. It doesn't get hit very often. I've also found that if you keep your hand relaxed when you do get hit, there's usually no damage. And I can say over the course of my entire career, there was only one foul ball that hit my throwing hand that caused me to miss any time. I missed two or three games when I was playing for the Houston Astros. But other than that, it's usually like any other foul tip. You shake it off and you move forward.
So a guy's 58 feet away, throwing 90 miles an hour, a batter swinging in front of my eyes, and I'm staying relaxed.
That's the goal.
Now, you mentioned balls in the dirt. They're a terrific weapon for your pitcher. I mean, to get a batter lunging at a ball that's dropping out of the strike zone. And so you get a lot of ground balls and a lot of strikes that way, and that's good for your team. But there's also the risk that that ball can get past you, the catcher, and a base runner can advance. You were known for being good at stopping balls in the dirt. Any particular tricks you used?
There's no trick to it. And really the important thing about keeping balls in front of you, this is how I often explain it. If I was a basketball player and somebody took a jump shot and I swatted the ball into the stands blocking a shot, everyone might ooh and ah. But the truth of the matter is that team gets the ball back because it went out of bounds, so it doesn't do us any good. That is very similar to catching. You can't just block the ball. You have to control the ball, because if you block it and it ricochets more than 5 feet away from you, the runner's going to advance anyway, and it hasn't done you any good.
Now, I want to talk about collisions at the plate. There are some collisions in baseball, like occasionally outfielders will collide with each other or the wall, and sometimes it happens among base runners. But the one time in baseball that a collision is intentional and accepted is when a runner is coming in from third, the catcher is waiting for a throw from a fielder, and the catcher's got to catch that ball, make the tag on the runner, and if you block the plate, they're allowed to plow into you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You are free game.
Tell us about how that works. I mean, would you block the plate and thereby induce a collision, or would you like to give them a path so that they would slide and try and avoid the tag? How did you approach that?
You know, every play at the plate can be slightly different, but going into it, this was my general approach. The ball gets hit to the outfield. There's a runner at second base. I know there's a possible play at the plate as soon as the ball's hit. So I get my feet set, usually at the front left corner is where I put my left foot, and I kind of point my toe towards third base, because if that runner slides into me, I don't want to have my toe pointed towards a pitcher's mound, and now the runner slides into the side of my knee. So I'm setting my feet ahead of time. And as the throw comes in, what happens more often than not is the throw takes you to where you go, because you have to catch the ball and apply the tag. So you have to go where the throw is. If it does come right to you and there's time to catch the ball and set, then that's probably when you're going to get hit. The general rule as a base runner is if you're running towards home and the catcher is about to catch the ball or already has the ball, that's when you want to hit him. That's when you want to either jostle him just before he catches it or hit him hard enough where he drops it.
You want to tell us one of your more memorable encounters there?
One clearly stands out above the rest. I was playing in Houston, and we were playing as the Milwaukee Brewers, and a player named Scott Posednik was on second base, and there was a base hit to center field where Carlos Beltran was playing, and there was going to be a play at the plate. The throw, kind of as I described, took me a little bit to my right, and I had to reach with my gloved left hand and come back towards home plate. And as I came back towards home plate, Scott Posednik hit me on the left side of my shoulder and mask, and I was actually spun around, my helmet came flying off, and I was unconscious for about 5 or 10 seconds.
Wow. I hate to ask you this, but did you hold the ball?
You know, it's ironically, I did. I didn't know it. I held onto the ball, and I landed face first in the dirt, and the pitcher, who was backing up home plate in case of an overthrow, had to come over and take the ball out of my glove while I was unconscious in case the runner at first, who had had the original single, tried to advance to the next base. And Scott Posednik, who had plowed into me and knocked me out, was actually called out.
Do you think the rule should change? I mean, you know, this doesn't happen at second base or third base where guys just go barreling into a fielder. And I got to see, even though as a catcher you've got some protection, the momentum is with the base runner. I mean, I remember Pete Rose actually ended the career of a catcher in the All-Star game once by plowing into him. Should the rule change?
No, I don't think there should be any rule changes other than with one caveat. I would say maybe take away the head hits. Any contact by the base runner at the catcher's head or above his shoulders could be deemed illegal. But other than that, home plate's different. Home plate is not second base. Home plate is not third base. When you cross home plate, you've scored a run, and one run can make the difference in a game. So for me, being a catcher, even though I know I could have been hurt while trying to block home plate or trying to apply a tag at home plate, home plate's not third base. If someone slides into third base, that's not going to win the game for them. The axiom in baseball is one game can be the difference between a playoff team and a team that goes home and plays golf. So one run could be the difference.
Now, of course, one of the most important things a catcher does is to call the pitches that the pitcher is going to throw. I mean, people who watch the game know that between your legs you will drop typically, I guess, one finger to signal a fastball, and then two, three, or four for various other pitches that the pitcher might throw, the, you know, a curveball, a slider, a changeup. And when you see this working well, it's interesting. You will see the pitcher get the ball back and this then almost go into the windup immediately. And I'm thinking for that to happen, the catcher must be making the decision on what pitch to call immediately, as soon as the last pitch is completed. Does it work that quickly? I mean, is that what you do?
Basically, yes. That's exactly what happens. A pitch is thrown, and as soon as you've thrown it back, there's kind of a checklist that you go through, and it becomes more reflexive as you do it more and more. And a veteran catcher, a lot of the checklist he just glosses over because he knows the answer to it. But you're really going through a bunch of different things in your mind, including what's the score, what inning you win, how many outs, what's this hitter's weaknesses, what is this pitcher's strengths, who's on deck, how did we get this guy out last time, what pitches did he see, what pitch did we just throw? So, I mean, there's about 10 to a dozen things that you kind of, a checklist you go through in your mind before you put that signal down.
Right, and then you can pick from four or five pitches that the pitcher throws, and it can be up or down or inside or outside. That's a lot of options that you've got to get through in a hurry.
It is, and you prepare for it. You know, it's that checklist you go through before every single pitch, but a lot of it happens beforehand. You know, we have pitcher and catcher meetings. On the teams I've played with, the catchers would get together and go over the entire offensive lineup or potential lineup, their strengths, their weaknesses, what can they run, do they hit and run, are they bunters. Before every series, I would have a stack of graphs, and they would have each hitter on the opposing team, what they did against right-handed, what they did against left-handed pitchers, what they did against curveballs and sliders against right-handed and left-handed pitchers, what they did against changeups and split-fingered fastballs against right-handed and left-handed pitchers. And this all gets condensed down into basically a sheet or a chart of strengths, weaknesses. And you use that as your cheat sheet before the game and when you're going over the lineup with the pitcher of that day. And so this all this decisions that go on during the course of a game, this starts long before the games begin. And in fact, you could even make the argument that when a new pitcher comes to a team, it starts all the way back in spring training when you are catching this new pitcher to your team and you're figuring out what is his strengths, what are his best pitches, what is his best off-speed pitch. And all this knowledge gets applied when you get into the game with that pitcher and you have to call pitches.
How many hours a week would you spend just doing the mental work? I mean, outside the game, just studying stuff, making graphs.
Well, I would do the graphs before every series, and that would take me a couple hours. And then you go over each lineup on a given day, which would only take about 20 minutes. And then I would spend another 20 minutes every game that I was catching going over the chart myself and looking at that day's opposing lineup and just giving myself a little refresher of what the strengths and weaknesses are of each player in the opposing team's lineup.
So a catcher then who knows his pitcher and knows all of the hitter's tendencies and calls a great game is a tremendous asset. You've also, though, got to handle your pitcher's psyche. If the pitcher's out there getting frustrated, not hitting his spots, and you trot out, I'm sure every conversation is different. But do you have to know, I don't know, do some pitchers bristle if you make a suggestion? Is it a matter of simple encouragement? Is it strategy? What do you say when you get out there and talk to them?
The one general rule I had, and this didn't apply every single time I went out to talk to a pitcher. There are times where I would have to get on a pitcher. But my general rule was, when I left the pitcher's mound after talking to any given pitcher, I want them to feel like they can get out of this situation. You know, baseball is a tough game. It's not as physically demanding as, say, football or hockey, but it's a tough game in the sense that it's pitch after pitch after pitch for 150 pitches a game for six straight months with very few days of rest. So when I left that mound, I wanted that pitcher, even if he was in the worst situation possible, if he was in bases loaded, no outs, with the tying run at third base in the bottom of the ninth inning, when I left that pitcher's mound, I wanted that pitcher to feel like, hey, I got a chance to get out of this. So my general rule was to be positive. Unless it was a guy who I knew could handle a little yelling or a little berating, I was generally very calm, and I walked away hoping that they felt like this is not an impossible situation.
And when somebody could take a little berating, what would you berate them about?
Usually when I was berating someone is because they were pitching what I would call scared. They were trying to avoid contact, or they were afraid that the hitter was going to hit the ball. In sports in general, you can't be afraid of failure, but in baseball, there's so much failure, you really can't be afraid of it. So the only time I would berate a pitcher or get on a pitcher would be when I felt like they were pitching scared on the mound and that they were trying to avoid contact because they were afraid of what was going to happen. So unless you were doing that, like I said, my general rule was to walk away with them feeling they could get out of that situation.
You know, Crash Davis, the catcher in Bull Durham, said you play the game with fear and arrogance. Did you like that movie?
I did like it. Yeah, it was a good movie.
There's a moment in that film where his young pitcher, Nuke LaLoosh, is shaking off his signs. And he says, I can't believe this guy's shaking off my signs. And after conversing with him at the mound, Nuke wanted to throw his fastball against a guy who always looks for a first ball fastball. The catcher then, Kevin Costner, tells the batter what's coming. Did you get irritated when young pitchers would shake your signs off?
I did. There were times where I did get irritated, especially later in my career when I felt like I had a generally pretty good knowledge of the hitters and situations. I don't mind being shaken off, and I would never make a pitcher throw a pitch he doesn't want to throw, because if he doesn't believe in it, it's not going to be successful even if it's the right pitch. I'd rather have him throw what he wants to throw even if it's the wrong pitch. But it would bother me at times when a young pitcher who had never seen the hitters before would come up and start shaking. It would also bother me sometimes when a pitcher would come out of the bullpen for the first time in a series, and maybe it's the third game of a four-game series, and he hasn't pitched or seen any of these hitters, and I've seen him for three straight days, and he'd come out and start shaking. Does that make me right and them wrong? Absolutely not. Like I said, I would rather they throw the wrong pitch with conviction than throw the right pitch half-heartedly. That being said, there are times, too, where I'll put a sign down and they'll shake, and I'll put it down again and they'll shake, and I'll put it down a third time and they'll go, okay.
Okay. This is the pitch. Now, this gets sensitive. Did you ever call for your pitcher to plunk a batter? I mean, this is a part of the game, they say, situations where you might throw at somebody or throw close to them.
Yeah. Yes, I have. You know, there are times where a team or a player – kind of breaks the baseball code, you know, whether it's trying to steal a base late in the game when the opponent had a big lead and didn't need to be stealing bases and scoring more runs, trying to stick it to us or show us up. If an opponent slides into our second baseman with cleats high, looks like he's trying to injure him, you know, there are times where you kind of take law into your own hands.
Would those calls come from the dugout, or would they come from you?
Both. You know, I've had managers tell me they want player X to be hit, and there's been times where I've walked up to a pitcher in the dugout and said, hey, when player Y comes up, drill him. So it's happened. It's happened both ways. It hasn't happened a lot, but it has happened, and it is part of the game. It has been for generations.
Now, if a batter comes up and thinks that he's being thrown at and things are getting tense, are there things you would say to diffuse the situation?
Yeah, especially if we hadn't tried to hit him intentionally. Usually if we tried to hit the person or it was an intentional plunking, I wouldn't say anything. I just try to strategically place myself between him and the pitcher in case he rushed out there. But if it was an accident, if we actually weren't trying to hit the batter and we did, then I'd try to explain to him that we weren't trying to hit him.
In general, is there much conversation between you and batters? I mean, can you ever get into a batter's head? Do you ever try and do that?
I didn't do it too much. You know, when I was hitting, I didn't, other than to say hello to the catcher, unless I was good friends with him, I didn't want to talk too much, and I know how hard hitting is. So I kind of left hitters, I left him alone when they walked in, other than to say hello. You know, there was a lot of guys who I played against for a lot of years, so certainly I'd say hello, how you doing? After that, it was business. Now, there are, you know, a handful of friends that I've known for decades that would come to the plate, and I might joke around with them. But as a general rule, other than a hello, I we both had a job to do.
Well, Brad Ausmus, it's been fun. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, Dave.
Brad Ausmus caught 18 seasons in the big leagues. He's a 3-time Gold Glove winner and ranks 7th all-time for most games caught. He's now a special assistant to the general manager for the San Diego Padres. Now here's that scene from the classic baseball film Bull Durham we just spoke about. Here catcher Crash Davis, played by Kevin Costner, has called for a curveball to start a hitter. On the mound, his pitcher Nuke LaLouche, played by Tim Robbins, disagrees. The scene is slightly edited for clarity.
Why is he calling for a curveball? I want to bring heat. Shake it off. Throw it you want.
Damn it. Time out. Hey! Why are you shaking me off? Huh?
I want to bring the heater to announce my presence with authority.
To announce your what?
To announce my presence with authority.
To announce your presence with authority? This guy's a first ball fastball hitter. He's looking for heat.
Oh, yeah? So what? He ain't seen my heat.
All right, me. Give him your heat.
Why is he always calling me me? I'm the guy driving a Porsche.
Fastball. Well, he really hit the shit out of that one, didn't he? Look at that, he hit the ball. Guy gets a free steak. You having fun yet?
Oh, yeah, I'm having a blast. Thanks.
Good.
God, the sucker teed off in that like he knew I was going to throw a fastball.
He did know.
How?
I told him.
Sly Stone is known to millions for the records he made with Sly and the Family Stone. But he had a career before he and the family got together, and at one point had his own record label, Stoneflower. Rock historian Ed Ward says Stone's other work adds another dimension to the career of this enigmatic character.
When you think of Sly Stone, this is not the sort of thing which immediately comes to mind. It's Free Advice, a single by the Great Society, recorded in December 1965, and featuring Jerry Slick, his wife Grace, and his younger brother Darby. It may not sound like it, but it took 53 takes to get this one, and the reason for that is right on the record label, which says, produced by Sly Stewart. By the time this was released, the young producer, a notorious perfectionist, had been working for Autumn Records, a label run by San Francisco DJ Tom Donahue and his partner Bob Mitchell, for 2 years. Donahue undoubtedly knew Sylvester Stewart as a fellow DJ who held down a slot on KSOL in the East Bay, and also knew that while Sly Stone, as he was known on the air, loved soul music, he was also way into British rock. Thus, when Donahue brought a band into the studio that he'd discovered in a San Francisco North Beach club, his young producer knew just what to do with them.
Follow your own beaten path. Wonder where you can be grand. Be aware of hidden dangers and don't talking to strangers.
Don't Talk to Strangers was the 4th charting single Sly had produced with the Beau Brummels. And while it did okay nationally, it was a big enough hit locally that the band was soon scooped up by Warner Brothers. Sly kept busy for Autumn, though, producing hits and misses for the Mojo Men and the Vegetables with a J, whose lead singer and drummer was Jan Errico. If that name sounds familiar, it might be because her cousin Greg was soon to emerge as the drummer in Sly's new band, The Family Stone. When Autumn fell apart early in 1966, Sly was already producing some sessions for Billy Preston, playing in San Francisco with his band The Stoners, and cutting demos with his brother Freddie's band, which already show the fusion of rock and funk.
We got you going? Or
Wait. No. That's what I said.
You really got me? Take four.
In 1967, the personnel of the Family Stone had gelled, and they were on their way to million sellers, Woodstock, and crossover success. In 1969, Sly and his manager Dave Kaperlik incorporated Stone Flower Productions, and soon they were approached by Atlantic Records, offering them a label in which to play Sly's productions. Sly's first two signings for the label were an old friend, Joe Hicks, and a trio called Little Sister, which did indeed have his little sister Vieta, known as Vet, and two of her friends. Little Sister had been a gospel outfit, but like Vet's big brother, they liked to experiment, and they didn't get many bookings, so Sly signed them. There's no doubt about who was backing them up, of course, and You're the One made it to 22 on the pop charts. The follow-up didn't do as well, but it did give a bit of insight into the new sound Sly was playing with. Stone Flower single by Joe Hicks remains one of the most disturbing records I've ever heard.
Good and bad, big and small, in and out, not at all. If it feels good, it's alright. If it feels good, it's alright. Tell me when you feel it.
The extreme compression, the minimalist backing dominated by the Ace Tone Rhythm Ace machine, and the lack of chord progression makes Life and Death in G and A a claustrophobic, paranoid experience. Sly was onto something else now, about to release There's a Riot Going On, and then disappear for 2 years.
Ed Ward lives in France. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Marlene Zook, can get a little defensive on the subject of insects. She's a biology professor at the University of California, Riverside, who's spent years studying animal behavior. She says while everyone loves watching eagles nest or observing the social behavior of chimps, few appreciate the complex behavior of our six-legged friends. In her new book, she says there's evidence that insects like ants and wasps display individual personalities and learn behaviors not embedded in their genetic code, and that insects show parenting skills and mating rituals that are simply amazing. Marlene Zook has written two previous books and articles which have appeared in several publications, including the New York Times. Her new book is called Sex on Six Legs: Lessons on Love, Life, and Language from the Insect World. Well, Marlene Zook, welcome to Fresh Air. You write in this book that insects bring home the uneasy truth that you don't need a big brain to do big things. Like, for example, learn from others. Can insects learn? Do we see this?
Yeah, insects can learn a lot more than people give them credit for. I think one of the things I tried to do in the book is to counteract this image people have of insects as mindless robots that march around driven by instinct and don't actually respond to their environment. But it turns out they learn all kinds of things. They can, and in fact, not only can they learn, for instance, where their food is or to avoid noxious stimuli, they can even teach each other. So they can teach another insect what to do, which is a really extraordinary accomplishment that not a lot of other animals, even vertebrates that we often think of as pretty smart, can do.
Okay, well, give us an example. I mean, how do we know we're not looking at simply a behavior that's embedded in their genes?
So with the learning, it's a behavior that's called tandem running in ants. It doesn't look hugely dramatic, I will confess. But still, it means that an ant who's found a food source will come back to recruit others to go to the same food source. And anybody who's ever had ants running around their kitchen knows that, you know, you get this trail. You don't just get one ant going back and forth. Well, the other ants find out where to go, not just from the odors that the first ant leaves when it goes back, when she goes back and forth, but also because an ant will find a nest mate and kind of run along beside her, sort of encouraging her where to go. One of the researchers that did this work says that it looks like a parent teaching a child to ride a bicycle, you know, where you're kind of going along next to them and along next to them, and you have your hand on the seat kind of guiding them along. And so they do this and steer the other individual, showing them where to go, and will actually wait for them to catch up and make sure they're going in the right direction and so forth, which, like I said, doesn't look very dramatic. It looks like two ants walking together. But in actual fact, it's teaching. But on top of that, there's at least some social insects that can recognize minute differences in facial appearance just the way we would. There are wasps that can determine which individual is which based on really subtle distinctions in the black and yellow patterning they get on the head. Just like, you know, you look at someone and look at the relative, you know, width of their nose and their eyebrows and so forth and can tell different people apart. They can do a very similar kind of thing.
Yeah, this is a fascinating experiment that you describe in which somebody actually captures these insects and does a little face painting on them. I can only imagine how this is accomplished. So they put markings on the faces of these. Were they wasps?
They're wasps.
And then what did they observe? How did they know that they were, that the wasps were really making these distinctions and these subtle differences?
So you can put two wasps together and they'll interact in a way just like, say, dogs would, where one of them will become kind of the top dog and one of them will become the subordinate. And there's really characteristic behaviors where you can notice that happening. And the same thing with wasps. You just need to know what to look for. You know, you could do this with any animal where then you say, all right, well, how are they telling? And then afterwards, they'll behave just exactly, you know, as if they remember who was dominant and who wasn't dominant when they were interacting before. So they'll, you know, if you put them together again, the one that had won the fight will be dominant and get, say, access to food and so forth. Well, if you take the one that was previously subordinate and you paint it to look dominant, or you take the one that was previously dominant and paint it to look subordinate, you end up with a slight change in behavior. So it's like they'll look at each other and kind of stop, as if you saw your friend wearing a mask. And some things about it look familiar, but wait a minute, the face is wrong. You look different. And the wasps have a really similar sort of reaction where they kind of stop and don't behave as though they would to the same individual. I mean, the actual mechanics of doing this, it is a little funny, and you do spend a lot of time, you know, working with really tiny things, and people who work with stinging insects do have special ways to not get stung and so forth. But
okay, you just got to tell me, how do we take a wasp and give it makeup?
You need to have a very calm wasp, a very calm wasp. Often you can either anesthetize insects. There's a couple of short-acting chemicals you can use, essentially you know, giving them anesthesia, or you can chill down insects, and that often slows them down enough that you can do things like that too, because remember, insects are cold-blooded, and so anytime you put them in a cold environment, they kind of go into suspended animation. So a lot of people who work with insects do that too. But the other thing is, and again, this speaks to kind of the insect phobia that I also talk about in the book, that insects are really not out to get you. Certainly, if you pick up a wasp and start messing with her, then yes, she's probably likely to want to sting you if you're not careful. But by and large, it's not like you're constantly having to defend yourself against these, you know, horrible, aggressive insects that if you're not careful will try to, you know, bite your hand off or something. So,
you study crickets a lot, right?
I do.
And you have a fascinating story about going into Hawaii and discovered there are crickets there who are quiet. What was going on and why was that interesting to you?
So we've been working for a long time on a species of cricket that's common all through northern Australia and the Pacific. It's sort of subtropical. It's been introduced to Hawaii. And in Hawaii, I stumbled on this really interesting relationship where the crickets are subject to a parasitic fly. And so the fly can hear the crickets calling. And crickets, of course, call to attract mates. So all the chirping you hear outside when you go outside on a summer night, all of that nice melodious sound is male crickets desperate for sex. Obviously, that's very important for evolution because the more they sing, the more they're going to attract females, and therefore the more they're going to pass their genes on. That's fine. The problem in Hawaii is that these crickets also, by singing, attract the attention of a parasitic fly. The fly can hear the song as well or better than a female cricket. She flies over, a female fly goes over to the cricket, deposits these larvae on and around it. The larvae burrow inside the cricket while the cricket's still alive and live there consuming his tissues for a week or so while he's gradually getting weaker but, you know, is still functioning. So it's like they've got preserved food to eat, the larvae of the fly do. And then eventually, after about a week, they burst out, just like the movie Alien, and kill the cricket, and then the fly pupates in the soil and becomes an adult fly. I got interested in this because from an evolutionary perspective, it's the perfect conflict. The more the male calls, the better it is from an evolutionary perspective, because the more females he's going to attract, so it's a good thing. But the more the male calls, the more flies he's going to attract, which is going to kill him, which is obviously a bad thing. And yet it's the same call that's attracting both kinds of insects. So how does evolution sort out these conflicting selection pressures? And so we've been studying that for quite a long time. The silent cricket that you just mentioned has been a really recent and really exciting development, which is that we noticed on one of the islands where the crickets occurred, we were finding fewer and fewer individuals, and we couldn't, you know, hear as many. I keep them in my lab, and I couldn't find as many females to lay eggs for my lab colony. And eventually I thought, okay, they're just going to go extinct. This is actually an introduced species with an introduced parasite, and sometimes that's unstable. So, all right, never mind. You know, these things are dynamic, and they're just going to go extinct eventually. But one day, we came back, and I didn't hear any crickets at all, but started to go to the field site anyway, figuring, you know, you may as well see if there's anything around. And I started seeing lots and lots and lots of crickets. So there were many more there than had been before, but none of them were making a sound. It turned out that they weren't making a sound, not because they were behaviorally refraining from it. It wasn't that they didn't want to. It was that they couldn't. Their wings now show this mutation that renders them completely silent.
So it protects them from the parasite, but what do they do for sex?
Ah, yes, exactly. I mean, it does protect them from the parasite because the fly can't find them if they can't call. But of course, then the female shouldn't be able to find them either. It turns out that it's not all the males that show this mutation. About 10 to 15% of the males are still normal winged callers, as per usual, and those can attract females just like any male could. The silent males, the ones that now have this mutation, get very close to the callers, hang around them, and in so doing, kind of take advantage of the females that are attracted to the callers and can mate with them as they move toward the singing males.
There's a lot of interesting stuff in this book about sex, reproduction, mating. And you found that the competition among males to reproduce has some interesting manifestations. And in many cases, that competition occurs after they mate. They have these particular physical adaptations to make theirs the sperm that does the job. Give us an example or two of this.
Sure. Insects are a great way to study how sex isn't really over when it's over. People tend to think that after mating has happened, well, since you can't see anything, then that must be it and everything is just finished. But in insects, and as it's turning out in lots of other animals, but insects are a great way to study this, if a female insect mates with more than one male in pretty rapid succession, as lots of insects do, then there's an opportunity for the sperm of those males. So the males themselves are long gone, but there's an opportunity for the sperm of those males to compete inside the body of the female in a process that's called sperm competition. And males have lots of tricks that they use to get their sperm to fertilize the eggs rather than another male's. So, for example, in damselflies, they've got these special scoops on the intermittent organ, the penis, in effect, of the male, that they can use to drag out the sperm from a previous male and replace it with their own.
Wow. And what's the evolutionary value of that? Why would a species in which males have that ability be more likely to survive? I mean, why would one individual's sperm be better than another? Why is that better for the survival and propagation of the species?
It's not that it's necessarily better for the species as a whole, but pretty much everything we see in evolution happens because it perpetuates the individual's genes that are, you know, doing whatever it is. So no, it's not necessarily better for the species, but it means that if I am able to displace the sperm of another male, then the genes for being able to displace the sperm of another male are going to be the ones that fertilize the eggs of the female that I just displaced the sperm from another male in. And so her offspring are all going to be able to displace sperm. Well, guess what happens? You end up with a population in which everybody can do this, and there's competition among the males to do it the best.
Now, there are also ways in which males try and get females to accept their sperm, right? I mean, some fascinating examples of that.
In a lot of Orthoptera, like crickets and katydids and their relatives, males produce sperm that's external. It's in a little package called a spermatophore. But in these species, it's attached to what's called a spermatophylax, which is this big globby thing that is has a lot of protein in it. It's very nutritious. And the female eats it while the sperm are draining into her body. Now, the males have to produce this before the female will mate. If he just goes up to her and just has the little sperm package, she won't mate with him. If he gives her the spermatophylax, she will mate with him. But the bigger and more nutritious it is, the longer she spends eating it, and therefore the more of his sperm drain into her body and fertilize her eggs. So there's a lot of selection on males to produce this very costly, what's called a nuptial gift. And it can often weigh up to 30% of the male's body weight.
There's some remarkable stuff in here about parenting, taking care of eggs, raising kids. And it's interesting to discover that there are plenty of cases where the dads take care, right?
Oh, absolutely. And let me point out that insects make great parents. One beautiful example that if people go out to streams and rivers, especially in parts of the American Southwest, that they can see are giant water bugs. And giant, of course, is a relative term. They're probably, maybe a little bit bigger than a dollar coin or something like that, which is, you know, big for a bug. And they live in streams. And the males actually carry around the eggs on their back for the whole time that the eggs are incubating. And then when they hatch, sometimes they'll take care of them a little bit more. Sometimes they'll just let them go. But the moms just lay the eggs on the back of the male and then swim off and never care in the world.
Any idea why that happens?
It's kind of a hard row to hoe for fathers to be the main caregivers because, of course, in insects, as in lots of other animals, it's never entirely certain that the father is actually the father of the offspring that come out of the eggs that the female laid because, of course, the fertilization happened inside the body of the female. And so she can lay these eggs and you can have mated with her, but what if she mated with somebody else? And so this is called certainty of paternity, and it means that in some cases at least, there's not a lot of payoff for males to take care of their babies because the babies might not really be genetically theirs. In the case of the water bugs, though, it's very clever because the female puts the eggs on the male's back before they're fertilized, and so then the male can put his sperm on them, and they're absolutely certain to be his.
Now, you also have this fascinating chapter on communication among insects, and you cite an example of how bees, where a hive has gotten big and a portion of the bees in the hive are going to go out and start a new one, will collectively scout out a location and then communicate, in effect, kind of have a debate and a decision about where they're going to go. Describe this.
So this is one of the most, I think, understudied and remarkable things that insects can do. We talk about complexity of behavior. They have complex decision-making. And, you know, you can liken it to finding a new place to live. Imagine if every time you found a new house, you had to find it with thousands and thousands of, you know, your friends and relations. Well, in this case, it's all your relations, but anyway. And you all had to agree on exactly where to go, exactly when to go there, and how to find your way. So bees seem to be able to do this by sending out scouts. So they'll send out a few individuals. When a hive is ready to split, they'll send out a few individuals that will go looking for an appropriate place to live and then come back and perform a dance behavior that indicates where this place might be. And by sort of putting the various dances together that the different individuals do, the bees are actually able to come to a consensus about where they're going to go. And then once they've reached that consensus, they all go there. And this is an amazing ability, again, because their brains are so small. And this is one of the reasons that insects are so cool to study, that we think decision-making is a tremendously complicated thing. It requires, you know, your forebrain. It requires your cerebral cortex. It requires all this gray matter. Bees don't have any of that, and yet they seem to be able to do exactly the same thing. One of the people studying the bees said, you know, it makes you wonder, what are we doing with our brains? What are they for?
Well, just to be clear about this, we're talking about a case where the dance isn't about, it isn't one bee describing a single, you know, new location for a potential hive. There are actually multiple locations.
Each dancer will describe a place where it has been, and then eventually the hive sort of weighs all of the various places and goes to one of them. And exactly how they do this and exactly what the criteria are for going for one place over another is still really being studied right now by lots of scientists.
Well, Marlene Zook, it's been interesting. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Marlene Zook's new book is called Sex on Six Legs, Lessons on Love, Life, and Language from the Insect World. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, and Heidi Simon. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.